This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytech, brings you Blowing Bubbles. Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world. How are people living their bubble lives? Working from home, keeping kids entertained, and staying connected and getting exercise. And how are these things presenting us with the opportunities to find new ways of living? Every weekday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann, Shan Gallagher, and Mara Karatai reach out from their bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world. Broadcast on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz and sustainablelens.org, bringing connection, joy, kindness and peace in the days ahead.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. We're talking with Venkatesha Chappella and Radhika Krishnan. Welcome to Blowing Bubbles. Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann. I'm at Triple IT in Hyderabad, where I've been for conferences. And this is part two of our conversation with Dr. Venkatesh Chappella and Dr. Radhika Krishnan. We've been talking about ideas of mixing computing and sustainability and how those come together in an Indian context. When I was preparing my keynote, I was looking for an Indian definition of sustainability, preferably a diagram, because I wanted to add it to my collection of diagrams and I wanted to be able to represent it. And I found quite a lot about, I've forgotten the term for the housing, but for living in harmony housing, but I couldn't find anything that was an actual single definition, and it almost seemed to me as though it was so implicit that it didn't need defining.
In a sense, yes, and I'm really surprised you brought this up, and it's almost as if a conspiracy theorist, that's me, you were listening on to our conversations, because just yesterday in the room above we were talking about the Indian definition of sustainability and the lack of it. So the student just starting her PhD journey was writing about sustainability in the Western context and how that definition doesn't quite fit into the Indian context, and how in the Indian context, in the social economic mess or beauty this India, sustainability is seen very differently, right? So I'll tell you how I think about it, or at least one of the ways one can think about it. Essentially, sustainability is connected to your idea of your relationship with nature, in a sense, right? And in the Indian context, the idea that nature is something that can be controlled did not traditionally exist, right? So you have a long tradition of thinking about nature as something to be both worshipped and to be feared and to be respected, in other words. So a lot of these narratives around sustainability come from this sort of understanding of a very organic relationship with sustainability. Let me talk to you about the story that Venkatesh and I did in that class we were talking about. So there's this tribe in eastern India, and they were asked to come up with, let me go back and quickly recap this. So there's a law in India which essentially allows every tribal person or every forest dwelling person to lay claim over forest land, okay, and to say, okay, this land is mine. So this group of villagers was told, you start coming up with land. And what did they do? They came up with a map of the area saying, this bit of land belongs to the local tiger, this bit of land belongs to the local rat, and so on. And the bureaucrat just lost it, saying, what the hell are you doing? You know, I mean, I can't go to the government saying, allocate land to a leopard or a tiger. And they just looked at him and said, but that's how we look at life, you know. So I think that's the closest you can get to a genuinely Indian definition of sustainability, because it stems from a very deep understanding of how humans need to relate with nature.
And I don't have the evidence for this, but I dare say this is probably exactly the way traditional societies across the world, New Zealand, wherever, Native Americans, they probably had exactly the same, the relationship you have with nature and what you call life. What you call life, inanimate things are living things. So that, I think that view of the world is probably what kept it sustainable. kept the world and them sustainable for, of course, thousands of years until everything changed in the last 500 years. The world is
so is there a residual survivor of that belief? Is that still there, of that ethos?
Yes, it is there in multiple forms. And see, I'm going to catch on to what Venkatesh just said. And that is something very useful. So think of, in India, we have this concept of the sacred grove. Okay, so the sacred grove is, well, it is imbued in all sorts of religious sense and all of that. But, you know, the basis of the sacred grove is a set of rules around the use and or sort of rules against misuse of the forest land. So, and the ecological logic behind the sacred grove was that, okay, you cannot cut that grove beyond a certain point. You cannot use that grove or misuse that grove beyond a certain point. So, and that's, the idea of the sacred grove is very much alive and kicking in many parts of India. It's still followed in many ways. So it is a residual kind of thing, but it definitely exists in pockets. And it is something that maybe can be understood in its entirety. And
of course, and I think this is where I want to go back to, how do you model this? I mean, I'm an engineer, you're an engineer. We know nothing about how to think about these as large problems. And these are not, see, as I was telling you the other day, in computer science, we start kids with problem solving. And these are, the problem I have with problem solving is the problems come packaged neatly on your table, and then you write a computer program, it has a while loop, and you know, it solves this little problem. And this is how we do engineering, right? We take little problems and we solve them. Unfortunately, when the student finishes 4 years of college, the student is looking for problems nicely, neatly packaged. And the real problems of the world are actually intractable.
Wicked problems.
They're wicked. So they are, and how do we approach those problems? How do we even start thinking about this? That's the part of education, I think, especially in engineering disciplines, is sorely lacking. I know for sure that here when we teach computers and programming, and we never look at such problems. Many of these are simple rate processes. They have enough non-mathematics and differential equations. Understand, if you grow something at this rate, what will happen? And then, you know, you're doing this, but then there's another negative feedback loop coming from somewhere, so you actually can't get where you want. Even if you want to grow exponentially, you will not be able to grow. So things like this, if you start telling people, I mean, take transportation, take, as you're saying, consumption of, I don't know, plastics, or take anything. Take any element that defines modern, industrialized, sort of consumption-based society. And you can play these games. You can build these models. I think what we are, if we want people to understand the gravity of this problem, we have to tell them and we have to show them, right? We have to show these people through models, through demonstrations, through graphs, through whatever it takes to understand this. You know? And then compare it, for example, with more sustainable models that still exist. So those choices are available. So it's not like, you know what, we're stuck in this, we have no option, and the train's just going to fall off the cliff. But we can't get off the trip. So this idea that there's an inevitability to this, that's the notion that I think we have to disabuse people.
You're talking about the sacred grove, the rules of forest land, and I can understand that that's still a thing that is embedded in some way in people's psyche deep, perhaps. But then you come to a place like Hyderabad. Are all bets off? How do people reconcile those?
Interesting. It's a good question, excellent question, and it's complicated. It's complicated because Indian society is. So what has happened is that, you know, in the city you have these, that you could have, in theory, these small pockets where essentially to alleviate our conscience, we preserve the ground. The ground. I say, all right, the Lord of ours is not going to punish us because we have preserved this bit, and that's how it works. As I said, the idea then is probably to push that idea of the sacred ground and make it more central. But I think the idea that in society you had such brilliant ideas about how to live, that needs to be explored a little. And every society has them. And I don't mean to sort of go back to the past. don't get me wrong. In fact, if you get me started on colonization and decolonization and so on,
that's my next question.
Yeah, but because see, I, again, that was a discussion we were having yesterday. See, of course, we have 200 years of colonization and so on, and therefore decolonization being a thing. And I, today in India and maybe in other parts of the South, you see a very problematic side of decolonization. As in, decolonization then becomes a reversal of any idea of liberty, equality, fraternity and the rest, because oh, those are ideas that are comfortable. So we have our own ideas of liberty, equality, fraternity and so on. Sounds good in practice, in theory, but in practice it just ends up being a very convoluted justification of some of the worst practices they think of. So, you know, decolonization has to be taken seriously, but also one has to be able to sort of judge frameworks of decolonization against certain sort of respected ideas that are kind of unique. So I'd say that, you know, bringing in these varying ideas of sustainability that emerge from different contexts across the globe, say from the tribes in, from the Maori tribes in New Zealand or from the Dongyako in Odisha, this is a grand example of decolonizing, okay? A great example of how you decolonize the idea of sustainability. That, you know, you're not really working with this instrumental idea of, this is what sustainability is. It's essentially a way of life. And you're trying to say that sustainability is connected to a way of life, to a way of thinking about nature.
Is or are colonization, modernism, and exploitative consumption, are they separable in an Indian context?
I would like to think that we should separate, because see, modernity in the classical sense comes with these five markers. We know that, right? I mean, the movement from community to a family, kinship changing, so on. There are some elements of modernity that are inseparable with environmental damage and so on. I'm not going there. But the one interesting definition of modernity was the idea of a secular citizen rather than somebody who thinks purely in terms of their ethnic or positional identity. And again, there's a lot of critique of that, and rightfully. But my thing is that one, especially in the global South, when you're seeing all these, you know, when you're seeing all sorts of tensions around religion, and you mentioned that, Venkatesh, earlier in the day, when you're not really able to think, you're able to think only linearly in terms of I belong to this religion, I belong to this category, and so on and so forth. At that point of time, one really needs to pick up at least that strand of modernity, where the idea is that I am a citizen who is governed by certain universal notions of equality, equity, diversity, and a certain idea. And I am not just sort of captured, I'm not entrapped in this idea of my religious or ethnic identity. That isn't the be-all and end-all of my existence. It is a very important part, but it does not define the entirety of me, and so on. I'm putting it very, very badly, but I think that part of modernity is important, because if you don't do that, you'll see what's happening in India, right? That anything and everything is going in the name of religious identities and so on, which then is a death knell for the idea of
formation. We're also, I think it's also important to remember that we are one of the fastest growing economies in the world, which India has, right? Struggled for many years. And part of the problems you see with sustainability are completely tied to the fact that we're a huge market economy. You're in a market economy, you have companies that are looking for not sustainability but profits. And this is the these are the canons of modern economics when it comes to, you know, understanding how things work. This is how economics works. So I see in the short run, I see this problem actually getting much worse. I mean, when I look at the horizon about, let's say, even 10 years, we're going to be having many more people flying, many more people buying cars, many more people traveling, eating, whatever, you know, junk food, things like that. So that's going to happen. I think in the next 10 years, we just need to brace ourselves. Vast increase in these patterns of, and all the accompanying problems that it leads to. Where in some sense people equate modernity with economic growth. You know, that is also the conflation that causes a lot of problems. And we need to have a definition of modernity, I think, which none of us actually have ever bothered to ask this question. Are we modern? In what sense are we modern? And what does it mean to be modern? What do you think it should? So a modern is simultaneously, sort of, to me, the way I look at it is to simultaneously adhere to these, to a set of values that are very local and perhaps have existed for many, many centuries, millennia, but also very global. And it's this connection with global and local that these networks of lots of things, you know, that ultimately have a global impact, you know, is what the ability to understand that connection is to be being, is about being. Something is happening in some part of the world, you know, how does it affect us? And if all of us are like this, how does it affect the entire planet? That's an idea of modernity. Modernity is not, you know, becoming very rich and suddenly adopting out of fashion often, you know, ideas from elsewhere. I think the idea of trying to connect them to what is happening locally. And this is a global thing. It's not just about India. There's nothing unique about India as such. You know, these are problems that are across continents. And there's nothing unique about India's culture either. There are other cultures, native cultures, that are equally rich and have had fantastic ideas about these. And probably very similar, I would say. There's unfortunately another idea that is floating around, very, quote-unquote modern, which is this notion of Indian exceptionalism, you know, which is, for example, what America had all these years and sort of justified whatever America did for all these years. And that idea of Indian exceptionalism is extremely dangerous because it simply says that whatever we do is the best for the whole world and we don't know what we're doing. If we want to, the idea of Indian exceptionalism is that we are the leaders of the world. But then if you don't know what you're leading people to, it's very, very dangerous. And I think that question, that needs to be questioned in a way that, challenge, because we don't know what is actually in store. People say that, you know, where I can see from reading history about, you know, the British saying that, the French saying that, the Americans saying that, there was a way of actually justifying colonialism. We are, you know, we are special and you are not, so we have a right to do X, Y, and Z. And that's a terrible way of sort of going ahead with an ideology that sort of seizes the whole country. Right? You sort of push this ideology that we are special. That's dangerous. That's actually not a modern idea at all.
Let's take the second of your music choices.
Sure. I don't know which is second.
One we had before.
Okay, I picked two other songs. One was, I'll start with the chronologically older one. This is a song, I think around probably the 18th century. This is about probably 200 years old, right? A little over 200 years old, perhaps. It's a song in the tradition of South Indian temple music. And the South Indian temple music has had a fairly long tradition, I would say, at least probably 500-600 years, if not longer. Probably much longer, in fact. of devotional music. Bards sing music praising the Lord. And it's beautiful music. And I grew up listening to a lot of, and actually so has Radhika, because this is music sort of native to most of South India. It's traditional music in the sense it's different from folk music. This is music that is more like classical music in the West, requires a lot of training, and the language, the lyrics, the music are actually very sophisticated. There's a very deep structure to it. In fact, it's a discipline. Even today, it's taught very traditionally. It's years and years and years to become a musician. So this is a piece of music that is sung. And of course, the Indian pantheon of Indian gods, you know, there are songs, hundreds and thousands of songs devoted to each one of them. And I think if I remember right, the song is about a god, an elephant god. And so gods and animals and, you know, humans, they're all kind of, they're part of the same society in some sense. It's very common to have, you know, a village god or a village goddess or a mountain god. So I think gods are very liberally used in India, which is a good thing. Because I think it literally adds life to things that should be living. I mean, it just emphasizes the living nature of things. I think what the scientific revolution in the West did was actually the opposite. Just said, you know, it made this very clear distinction between things that live and things that don't. whereas traditional societies don't meet the distinction. Anyway, I'm sort of going off on a tangent here. But this particular song is part of a larger genre of songs, where temple music was a big part of people's society. In this case, it happens to be Hindu temples. Also, the same thing was true with Muslim shrines. People had their music there as well. Other shrines as well. Of course, in the West, you have gospel music and so on. So the very rich musical traditions associated with churches, temples, mosques, and so on. So this is an example of that. In fact, around this time, I think mid-18th century, I think early 19th century and mid-18th century, there was a sort of a renaissance of these temple musicians and music, which probably started a little earlier, in fact. And that music is very alive. It is sung, almost on a daily basis in many parts of the country, especially South India. And of course, the same thing is true with the North. And I think there was also a similar movement, in fact, a much larger movement, if you will, in other parts of India, Western India, South, Eastern India, Northern India, where music also became a way of emancipation. It also became a way of questioning society and hierarchies and so on. So it's kind of, as she was talking about resistance music, there's this other music which sort of challenged the church, if you will, the religious structures. It openly challenged them. Ironically, which I think sort of saying, appealing to another, a similar God or a similar form of God, a formless form of God.
Yeah.
The whole, what is it called? I'm forgetting the name.
Yeah.
Anyway, it'll come back. But this whole movement, which is beautiful because it is using music, it quickly appeals to people and sort of gets to the essence of divinity and your connection with divinity without going through this whole complicated.
Yes. It's a direct conversation
with God.
The idea that don't let structures just come in the way of your conversation. So it's deeply subversive that way.
Exactly. And I think that basically it's also a way of getting people to realize that a lot of the religious structures are actually political structures. They're there in place to assert a political power and control of people. And this type of, not the kind of music I'm telling, not the song I pick, but other kinds of songs which I should pick up here, the Nirguni, that's the word I was looking for. Literally means propertyless. So it's God who's propertyless.
So it doesn't have form, figure, nothing. It's all over the place. You are having this lovely conversation, this person, this thing which has no form and no property.
So I think that whole genre of music is absolutely fascinating. I find it's also extremely appealing. It is sung to this day. I mean, you will find in India people singing songs that are 1,000 years old. I mean, on almost an everyday basis. So it's not that they're only sung in temples or they're only sung in. The kids learn it. And I think that continuity is fascinating.
ಹರಾದಿ ಗುರುಗುಗ ತೋಷಿದ ಬಿಂಬ ಹಂಸಧ್ವನಿ ಭೂಟಿದ ಗೇರಂಬ ಹರಾದಿ ಗುರುಗುಗ ತೋಷಿದ ಬಿಂಬ ಹಂಸಧ್ವನಿ ಭೂಟಿದ ಗೇರಂಬಿಗಣೇ ಅಂಬಾರಣ್ಣ ಅದೇವಾರೀವಾದಿಗಣವ ತಿಂಬಜೆ ಪಗರೆ ಸರಿವಾತಾಪಿ ಗಣಪತಿಂ ಭಜೇಹಂ ಗಪಗ ಗರಿವಾತಾಪಿ ಗಣಪತಿಂ ಭಜೇಹಂ ಸರ್ರಿ ಗಾ ಗರ್ರಿ ಗಾ ಗಜರ್ರಿ ನಿಜರ್ರಿ ಮಾತಾರಿ ಸಾಲಿ ವ ನಿ ಪಗ ಪಗಾರಿ ಸರ್ರಿ ವ ಗರಿ ನಿ ವ ನಿ ಸ ಪ ನಿ ಗ ವ ಗರಿ ಸರ್ರಿ ವ ಸರಿ ಗ ಪ ನಿ ಸರಿ ಗ ಪ ಗ ರಿ ಸರಿ ಗ ಗ ರಿ ಗ ಪ ಗ ವ ಗ ರಿ ಸ ni pa ni sa ri ri ni ri ni pa ga pa ga ri sa ri pa. So pa ga pa ga ni pa ga sa ni pa ga ga ri ni pa ga pa ga ri ni pa ga pa ni sa ri ri sa. Gagari gari zani zani pani divada pagari zani vagari gavagari.
Before the song you mentioned how the gods break down the distinction between the living thing and the not living thing. Is that coping with, or does that provide insight into AI? Is the AI sentient, and how does it change how we think about it?
Actually, I found your question extremely amusing. I'm sorry.
That's really
I'll tell you why. Because we had this short conversation about this. You think of AI as some kind of a supernatural, formless thing. Which it is, okay. And is able to pronounce great words of wisdom, which, by the way, it isn't right now. Okay, then I can buy the idea that it is some sentient being, which people will perhaps in some future world connect with. But fundamentally, the problem I have with this idea is, if you take this idea of living versus non-living, right? Modern society has a very clear notion of what is living. The fact that we're flirting with this idea that AI could be living is a very new thing. For example, in the Industrial Revolution, you had machines. I don't think anyone mistook, a lathe or a milling machine for a living thing, right? It was very clear these are mechanical devices, large, that can do things. Then we slowly moved to the information age. We had, televisions and radios, and people could naively think, and if you perhaps took a radio to somebody who's never seen it before, they actually think it's living. Hey, it's talking to me. To that extent, anything can be considered living. And that's, I think, the beauty of this whole notion that you can interact with it. When is something living? When you have a relationship with it. And when do you have a relationship? Because you can interact with it. And if I have an AI system that I can interact with it, and maybe it can, pacify me when I'm angry, and it can commiserate with me when I'm sad and whatever it is, then I will attribute living qualities to it. But I think the sense in which I'm talking about living and non-living here, especially when it relates to things like sustainability, is of a different kind, because that relationship develops over centuries or millennia, if not longer. And that relationship is also based on reverence.
Exactly.
And you don't just say this mountain is living because you say it's living because, it talks to me, it gives me things, I give it things, and there's a relationship that develops. And if you look at all the mythologies in all these cultures that are around in India and perhaps many other parts of the world, these are mythologies where this idea is taken extremely seriously. Even today in India, people will, this better than me, people will go trek far away to a temple on a mountain. They say the mountain is holy, not just the temple is holy. Kailash Parbat, they would say. So it's actually the mountain that's holy. So lots of things. The rivers are holy, the goddesses. The rivers are all named after goddesses. Many of them are Ganga and so on. So I think the notion which we think of life, technology has had, in fact, just the opposite effect. If you look at the song that we were talking about, the first song that we talked about, in fact, it's a complete antithesis to life. It's really depleting life, if you will, from that environment. And so I think I see modern, I would dare say, Western society has a certain comfort with technology. I see this often everywhere, which perhaps we don't see it in other places, probably because we don't have access to the technology, but also perhaps our own mental blocks when it comes to technologies, given our other connections with other things, I think that has a role to play. I'm not sure if that's ever been investigated by anyone, but I see West adapting to technology very easily, which I don't see. People do it, but even growing up in an engineering university, you don't see it. So I've never understood why. I mean, are we in some way not equipped? In what way are we not equipped to look at technology? I think it comes with a certain comfort with it.
Are there Indian notions of data sovereignty? And is data treasured in a way that's more than privacy?
Interesting question. So data exists in multiple forms. It exists as bits and bytes for us, but it also exists in the real world, on carvings, on stones, you know, your practices. That's all data, and it's all knowledge, right? So data to me, knowledge is probably the more appropriate word, right? So knowledge is carried around by people who practice it, who store. We're talking really about, the moment you say data, you know, it seems that it's associated with storage, right? You have to store it somewhere. And it sort of also removes the semantics from the data, the meaning of the data. So to me, a data in any society exists primarily in people and processes, what we do. Of course, I have bank account data. I'm not talking about that kind of data. But if you're looking at, especially with traditional data, and traditionally how data has been quote-unquote stored, it is mostly through art, music, you know, knowledge systems that, traditional knowledge systems. So for example, in India you have, I'm sure like many other countries, you have traditional systems of medicine, you know, for example. Traditional systems of all kinds of things. Cooking. And a lot of the traditions are oral. So they're saved.
It's going to get there.
They're all oral. They're passed from generation to generation orally, through songs, through music, through you know, mothers telling their daughters, and that kind of, a lot of very, very valuable knowledge. In fact, when we cook, you know, I just know how to put some of this, masala or something, only because I didn't read it from a textbook, because I saw my mother do it, and my wife saw her mother do it, and so on. So I think that the traditions that are passed, and a lot of the data is, in fact, if you will, embedded in those things. And I see, okay, the other question yours is about privacy, right? Privacy is, there are two parts to it. There's this modern notion of privacy, that my data belongs to me, which, by the way, is being flagrantly violated everywhere, thanks to modern technology itself. But there is a notion of privacy that I think exists in the West. West is kind of a loose term in modern societies, that doesn't exist in India. For example, you live in a large family, in a house with 8 family members. Your notion of privacy is very different there. You don't really look for those kinds of privacy, look for privacy in those forms that you would otherwise. On the other hand, there is also a notion of privacy that is very deep in India, whereas certain things are simply not discussed. They're not discussed. And I'm not saying that is a good thing. I'm simply saying that they're just off the table, that totally taboo, which the West has actually very little difficulties. At least modern societies, I shouldn't say West, I say modern societies, we've grown up with this modernism. For example, up until recently, it was absolutely taboo to discuss, and this is not true about India, this is true about homosexuality was off the table, it was just off the limits in many parts. But interestingly, in India, again, there are traditions where it was not just recognized, it was even celebrated.
Precisely.
Right? So there, I think this notion of privacy is a very fluid thing. There are lots of aspects to it.
Just add to that about interesting stories. Say when these patents were being signed up and so on, there is turmeric, which is in many parts of India called haldi. So suddenly turmeric growers in India were told that, sorry, you know, this is owned by this company and you have to pay a huge amount to grow it, regrow it and so on. So then they scrambled around trying to figure out how do we establish ownership. And one way of doing that was actually tied up to what Venkatesh was talking about, oral traditions. So they went back to figuring out how at some point of time, somebody discovered some particular health benefit of eating turmeric or of using turmeric in a certain way. And they said, look, you didn't know that, we knew that, so now we own turmeric. Okay? So it was this very odd, I thought, coming together of a very modern system of private control and private rights. And a very traditional way of thinking about, there was no written record, okay? It was this oral tradition. if you're sick of this particular kind of sickness, use turmeric in this particular way, and there you go, you're okay. You know,
so I think there's a more fundamental issue here, and that is actually the notion of ownership. What does it mean to own something? And I think a lot of modern economies are built fundamentally with the idea that you own something. I own something, there's trade, exchange, but primarily there's a notion of ownership. You know, I own wealth, I own land, I own data. So if you're looking at data, you know, data is a commodity. It's like land is a commodity. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, petrol is a commodity. So the moment you commodify it, it becomes something that you can trade. And I don't think traditional societies across the world had this notion of ownership. They didn't have this notion of owning land. You'd find it very, very strange to me.
Bubble sprite of the forest of Orokinui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, ngā mihi aroha nui kia koutou, katoa ho. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars in your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are, whatever's happening around you, this journey that we're all on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining, and illuminating for you more and more each day, who you are. A triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique, and here, making things better. Thank you. Now, I know that for us all, the last several years have been very tough, and it's so important that we acknowledge this and we give ourselves the compassion, the time, the space, the love, the care, the support that we also richly deserve and innately can provide, which is something I love about us as a species. And of course, at this time of year, when the sun is shining, the birds are singing, the birds are breeding, the birds are nesting, you know, there's a beautiful sense of abundance and fecundity, fertility. There's sweet nectar in the air. It's just really, really paradise time of year. So how wonderful that we can all gather together and celebrate at this time of year. And I was very lucky to do the lighting of the Christmas tree again this year, which I really, really love. And so this is a big event in the middle of Aotearoa's Dunedin in the Octagon. And they make this giant tree. And it's absolutely huge, you know. It might be like 10 metres tall, or bigger than that. 15 metres tall, I don't know, but it's absolutely huge. Anyway, and that's all decorated and everything like that, and it's beautiful. And basically, every year, I think for the last 5 years, I've been very fortunate, and I've been able to be, you know, the one to light it all up with everybody. And when I started, it was a brand new tree, so it was all new, you know, and we sang happy birthday to the tree. And I chose to name the tree Marilyn after this beautiful lady that used to do the events at the Dunedin City Council. And so we all sang happy birthday to Marilyn, which was lovely. And she was there and she was very touched, you know, so that was really good. And it's all sorts of different people come along to it from all over the world. They're beautiful families, they're beautiful children. We have lovely music. My band played this year, which was very special. And we learned some Christmas songs and we played them in our own style. And that was really, really fun. And just being there with all the children is lovely, and talking with them about, you know, their vision for their Christmas, and really, really beautiful time. So I think, you know, at this time of year, people are so open to that beautiful sense of connection with those we love, and that beautiful sense of freedom from, you know, the routine and our working lives, having some time off together. And people are, although there is stress around preparing for this time, people are in many ways moving in a different direction and in a different frame of mind, which is lovely. And so I've been finding, you know, over the last few days, just going around, and what I do is I buy a big box of Orokinui Eco Sanctuary calendars, and I just give them out to everybody because I think I love, you know, I'm obsessed with Orokinui, but also it's lovely to get a calendar and see all the beautiful animals. And this year, our calendar has all these photos of different native animals, but they're really focused on their faces. And it's just lovely seeing how these close interactions happen, which we don't often see when we're visiting and we're observing them from a distance because we want to respect them. So this made me think, of course, about our own interactions as a species of animal, and how, you know, throughout our day and throughout the next several days in this festive season, we're going to have the opportunity to have these really beautiful interactions. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to really tune in to those interactions that I'm having. I'm going to really be present in that moment. I'm going to really slow down, so really enjoy the interaction. And I think that will be really rewarding. I certainly feel that in my work with children, always really easy to be really present, really easy to be really engaged. But I'm going to do this with other people as well now, and I think it will be really positive. So I really hope for you, you have some beautiful interactions coming up, and I'll look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks so much. Ka kite.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. We're talking with Venkatesh Chappella and Radhika Krishnan. Do you think that there are other things that are difficult to systematise and perhaps shouldn't be systematised? And I'm thinking of things like collective ways of knowing.
Yes.
It's just not a thing that the computing systems that we've developed, they just don't align. And it's not just our computing systems, it's the education systems that we essentially build on top of computing systems. Mm-hmm. And so that because we don't have a way of capturing those sorts of ideas, the computing is kind of operating as a barrier to us actually finding ways of doing things.
Let me give you an example. So let's say you want a data bank. You see the society and you want to store the knowledge. They have a knowledge system. How are you going to store it? Okay. I have a special way of making turmeric milk, let us say. Okay. Are you going to write down an algorithm says, you know, this is what these people did? Or are you going to actually have a society of people who have those practices, right? And you sort of preserve that practice. If you encode that practice and put it in data, you're putting it in cold storage. And then, by the way, that data is owned by somebody else, and you know, at least in theory, it's possible that that entire data could vanish. Anything is possible. But the end of the day, these are quote unquote, if you want to think of them as data, you're not going to store them the way that you want. I mean, these are living things. These are activities of societies that are preserved by preserving those practices and not freezing them in millions of bytes.
ये हम के और चार दिन से तम के और चार दिन ये दिन भी जाएंगे गुजर गुजर गए हजार दिन ये गम के और चार दिन से तम के और चार दिन ये दिन भी जाएंगे गुजर गुजर गए हजार दिन
कभी तो होगी इस चमन पे भी बहार की नजर
अगर कहीं न स्वर्ग तो उतार ला जमीन पर तू जिंदा है तू जिंदगी की जीत में यकीन कर अगर कहीं है स्वर्ग तो उतार ला जमीन पर तू जिंदा है सुबह शाम के रंगे हुए गगन को झूम कर तू सुन जमीन गा रही है कब से झूम झूम कर सुबह शाम के रंगे हुए गगन को झूम कर तू सुन जमीन गा रही है कब से झूम झूम कर
तू आ मेरा श्रृंगार कर तू आ मुझे हसीन कर
अगर कहीं है स्वर्ग तो उतार ला जमीन पर तू जिंदा है तू जिंदगी की जीत में यकीन कर अगर कहीं है स्वर्ग तो उतार ला जमीन पर तू जिंदा है
That is, okay, so that's a song about, in some sense, a nationalist song, if you will. It's really a song of hope, in fact, as opposed to the other song. This is also modern, I think it was like 50s, 40s.
Yeah, at least.
Yeah, I think pre-independence. I'm not sure if it's pre-independence, actually. But around mid-20th century. So it's a song of hope. It's a song of action and hope. And it's a song of inspiration. It's one of the songs that you sing when you're... you know, you, when you're... when it's almost like a marching song, actually.
And it basically says, dream of the vegetable.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So that song will come. Mm-hmm.
I think the song essentially says, don't just talk about heaven, but bring it to earth. You know, what's the point if heaven is over there?
So all the things we've been talking about, let's call them under a broad banner of sustainability, just for argument's sake. Let's bring it back to teaching. How do we teach those things? How do we integrate them with the fact that they want to know how to code? And that we've got to teach them other things like structured development methodologies and agile development methodologies and whatever else.
Okay, so I see this as kind of a very narrow, specialized question. Essentially, the question is, as a computer scientist or a software engineer, how do I connect what I'm doing with, you know, all the other stuff we've been talking about? And to me, the way I look at it is, and that brings me back to the question you had posed, you know, what is the purpose of teaching people computing? I think one interesting purpose is, you can do lots of interesting, fun things with it. You can make a lot of money, as you said. But the other thing is, you can also tell people about rate processes, how things grow. And we talked about this already. And you can build little models, right? That you can build little models of anything you want. You can build a little model of a society. You can build a little model of a city. You can build a little of a transportation system. And I think the biggest benefit I have, you know, the biggest, the one thing you can do really well with computers, of course, you can solve problems. And we package them as well, problems. But the one thing you can really do is model and get an insight into how things work. You know, there are processes, and computation is really about processes. How a process unfolds.
So long as we don't forcibly oversimplify those systems, because that's what we have to do to make them codable.
That's true. There's always a danger of that. The point is, you can build fairly complex models. For example, I keep thinking of these climate modeling. You know, I used to be in the US working in a lab where some of my colleagues. So you can model fairly complex things, how the climate's going to change and so on. What you want is, of course, you want kids to build these models, and at the same time, you also want to tell them the limitations of these. And of course, the way you code can impact, you know, what you can limit. But primarily, I don't see that as an issue. I mean, it's not. Yeah, computers can do certain things and they can't model everything. But the kind of things that I'm talking about right now, which is, you know, modeling cities, modeling environments. In fact, I always wondered, you know, people...
Why they don't?
Let's say I have a policy. I have COVID happening suddenly. I need to have a policy of where should the medicine go, how should people travel. That would be a beautiful model to build in a classroom, which is very practical, very topical, and it can involve some very interesting models. And your coding and all your practices about coding can really get to about how to solve an optimization problem at a fairly large level as opposed to a very small scale. Make this program run faster is probably all we teach about optimization today.
Yeah, we need to get that make it run faster to building models, yeah, and having students build models of social justice or
exactly.
Biodiversity collapse.
Yeah, how do I model
or...
something that has greater social justice?
Yeah.
I mean, how do I even... begin to teach that.
Deeply subversive programming.
Deeply
exactly.
Subversive programming, but subversive in a particular way. See, Venkatesh and I have been about this for a while. See, the problem I see it right now is that students are laser focused on solving a certain kind of problem.
Yeah.
And they're pretty good at it. Sometimes they're very good at it. The problem is they're not able to see connections and interconnections. They don't think in terms of a large system, which is a very complicated system, with multiple feedback loops, with multiple heart stops, if you may, or, you know, various constraints kicking in unexpectedly. They're not used to modeling that in. And when modeling becomes that complex, that's when I think even students will, some of them will give up because it's too complex. But it just could be a very interesting way of getting them interested in understanding themselves as part of a very complicated system. You were talking about socio-ecological systems. It's precisely that. It's a complicated system.
I think we should start teaching in our curricula large systems models. And that we don't, we, in fact, we do the opposite. We expose them to
small ones.
Very well-defined problems with very well defined notions of correctness and efficiency, which is anything like what the real world. And we don't take them to the other end of the spectrum. Totally intractable problems, totally ill-defined notions of efficiency and correctness and justice, sustainability, etc., etc.
It's hard to justify to an assessment committee or an exam board or whatever you have to do that you're asking a question for which you don't know the answer. And there might not be an answer.
But that's the world, right? We are dealing with
questions
that we don't know the answer.
Our examination boards are way behind, and most often they lack honesty. They lack imagination completely. They're just decades behind. I think places like ours, which enjoy the autonomy, must take the lead in offering an elective. And in fact, we do. We have a first year course taught to students in electronics, and I think I'm not sure if the CS students enroll for it, but they do have a course on systems systems thinking. I think that's what it's called, mm-hmm. System science.
I think it's only for electronic students.
I think it's only for electronic students. Yeah.
And it very consciously incorporates biological and ecological systems.
Yeah, it talks mostly about biological systems.
Biological systems.
Yeah, perhaps. And I think that's a course that should be taught to everyone.
How do you teach that to engineers in a way that they don't see it as a problem which can be reduced to numbers if they haven't got the care or empathy driving that?
They need to work with people who are not engineers, which is exactly the idea I really liked about your talk was you get people, part of your education in computing is to work with people who don't do anything, and that's your computing education. And unless you bring that, we will fail in this activity because it's seen as a purely programming activity. It just becomes a game. You're essentially building a game at that point. And
yes,
I think,
yes, absolutely. And that conversation between computer scientists has to have manner. See, the problem we face nowadays is you try to do this collaborative work, and the first question that the CS person asks you is, "Tell me the problem, and I'll solve it." And I find that deeply
it's very arrogant, actually.
Arrogance is one part of it, but not useful. One has to approach the problem from a certain, sense of, okay, I'm trying to understand how you're defining your problem to begin with, and why are you coming, what's your way of understanding? Once we start that conversation, then a genuine sort of collaboration can work.
Yeah, where the conversation.
That conversation has to happen, not just give me a requirement specs. And I think this is very CS. It's a very CS.
But also,
give me requirement specifications.
This is a discipline that is tremendously influenced by the industry. We are essentially beholden to the industry, and these are the problems that come with that.
Yes, I have a problem.
Yes.
With the whole notion of problematize being the first thing we have to do. If we have a baby, we don't see it as a problem. We see it as a beautiful thing to nurture.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we just approach it at a different way of thinking.
Exactly. That's a beautiful example.
Yes, absolutely.
So I have some questions to end the show. And it's Radhika's turn, because Venkatesh went last week. Can you remember what the questions are?
Yeah.
What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Okay, that's a toughie. Basically, I've spent the last 7 years here in IIIT doing something that I never thought I'd end up doing, which is trying to bring together computational tools and the social sciences. And I won't call it a success, but it's been a very interesting journey and I've enjoyed it. So, as I mentioned, I think earlier, using GIS tools to understand land use changes, using NLP tools to understand environmental narratives and so on, it's been an interesting journey. But personally speaking, I think my success, something that has given me the most happiness, is essentially introducing engineers to a whole lot of things that they normally don't hear. So the occasional email I get from a student saying, "Oh, I never thought that this thank you for introducing me to this thing and this idea, this way of thinking. That for me is something that I've really treasured and I will treasure.
So what's your superpower?
I don't think I have a superpower. Not really, no.
Okay.
Yeah.
Venkatesh, what's her superpower?
Radhika, I'm not going to say she's a superpower. She's a power. And I think what I enjoy most talking to Radhika and hanging out with her is at least the first time I've had a colleague who's been, frankly, been very inspiring. She has a view of the world that most of us and our students don't have. She's been out there in the field, working with people directly who are being affected. And I think that story itself is so inspiring. And I think the power of what we see from that, and I want our students to see through the classes we've taught together and so on, is that completely different view of what the world is. And here are people who are sitting in IIIT, but also going and working with people out there. I think that itself is a great source of inspiration.
You happy with that?
Yeah, I suppose. I do know that students find, some students at least, find me to be a very odd person because I talk to them about things that they've never thought about. And, well...
I think that's the... that ability to challenge our assumptions. And not everybody does it. I mean, most of us just teach the next class on data structures and we're done.
Yeah. So you were a student activist. Are you an activist now?
No, I wouldn't consider myself to be an activist. But, you know, the way I see it, an activist never really finishes being an activist. So there are classes where I kind of feel that I am donning my activist hat because much as I try, I cannot really be neutral in a certain situation. And I do decide mentally, I am going to talk about this and I'm going to talk about it in a specific fashion. So yes, I suppose I continue being an activist of sorts in some spaces. I was, yes, a student activist. And I enjoyed those days.
Pretty sure there's a joke about activists never move on. They just, what they want now is a car.
yeah, I know that joke.
So what motivates you?
I think I like, and I'm going to sound really corny here, but I like making, I'm a people pleaser, unfortunately. And I like I like making a situation nicer. In any small way that I can, and every day I do try to do that. And I know I'm sounding extremely corny, but that's so even my activism kind of stemmed from there. Just wanting to do something that is different, making life more comfortable.
So what challenge are you looking forward to, or opportunity?
Well, there are huge challenges right now, and I think part of the challenge is essentially having the freedom to do what you want to do, which we do have that freedom here to some extent in IIIT, to a large extent in fact. But given what's happening around the world, that is a real challenge. We're constantly trying to figure out what we can say and what we can't say, what we can do and what we can't do. It's a big challenge, and I'm just talking about that big challenge. So, yeah.
So lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
I think the same advice as Venkatesh, keep your eyes and ears open and don't be a learner. Learn to hear, learn to listen to a whole lot of people and to figure out why they're saying what they're saying. And learn to explore life. Life isn't as simple as what you think it is, especially for computer scientists, yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining
me. Thank
you
for having us.
Thanks so much.
Yes.
It's fun.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.